You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our look at the book, What's Yours is Mine, Against the Sharing Economy by Tom Slee. We were looking at the chapter Erosion. Capital demands uniqueness as it demands homogeneization. For global capital to make money from a city's uniqueness, it must be able to fit into that city in worldwide operations. Hotel chains need to be able to build their preferably standardized hotels. Charter companies need airports. Marketing departments need messages that are recognizable across the world. The more a city has, the more there is pressure to squeeze into it the homogenization templates of global tourism and global trade. The rise of Barcelona to prominence among the cities of Europe has been in part based on its steady amassing of symbolic capital and its accumulation of marks of distinction. From its architectural heritage to its Catalan history, these unique qualities are a source of rents for the tourist industry. These bring homogenization, commoditization in its wake in the Western world. The stupefying congestion of the traffic leads to pressures to put boulevards through parts of the old city. Multinational stores replace local shops, and Barcelona loses some of its marks of distinction. Airbnb erodes the commons by gentrification of its biggest markets, which are the world's major tourist destinations. Harvey's comments about hotels apply to Airbnb as well. Barcelona loses its mark of distinction as residents are driven out by a proliferation of rental apartments. Even when the company pays taxes on behalf of its hosts, it refuses to give to the city governments the names and addresses of these hosts, making it almost impossible for democratically elected city governments to manage the impact of tourism on some of their most valuable neighborhoods. Airbnb also demands homogeneization. It operates in 34,000 cities and chafes at the inconsistency of regulations. But each city is different, and the inconsistency or variety of regulations is a feature, not a bug. The ideas of urbanist Jane Jacobs have been a prolific source of ideas about the wake of commons in our daily lives. But technology organizations such as Code for America, who seek to combine Jacob's ideas with software to work to change the way cities work through technology and public service, are pursuing a contradiction. They seek to force the uniqueness of individual cities into standardized frameworks in order to build software that works across many cities. The very idea of a one-size-fits-all solution to a bottom-up city innovation is flawed, because every application that is successfully implemented in a large number of cities erodes the uniqueness that makes those cities distinct. Beyond this, the notion of welcoming civic startups as somehow different from other money-making enterprises ignores the conflicting demands of sharing and money-making and will eventually lead to the erosion of civic commons. There is a recursive nature to the commons. Collective management demands trust and the maintenance of reputation. But trust itself is a shared resource that requires tending. So informal management regimes are themselves commons, hence the language of self-organization. A commons may be managed by a common, just as a common resource is shared in a non-commercial fashion, so the tasks of monitoring and enforcing community norms are shared in a non-commercial fashion among those who have a stake in the health of the underlying commons. Sharing economy companies use software reputation systems to manage marketplace reputation as a common. The reputation system itself, with all the evaluations and ratings that populate it, become a valuable common resource. Individual ratings for hosts of Airbnb contribute to the non-commercial collective tending of trustworthy information about the standards of accommodations. As with any other commons, market-driven motivations are anathema to fair ratings. If a host pays you to give a high rating, you are automatically eroding the value of the reputational system. And a gamed reputation system undermines the value of the whole site, and a community of hosts and guests with it. Distortion. As capital is attracted to a successful common, the nature of the common itself becomes a matter of dispute. Harvey gives an example of the reconstruction of a historical dock area in Liverpool. Quote, the initial erasure of all mention of the slave trade in the reconstruction of Albert Dock in Liverpool generated protest on the part of the excluded population of Caribbean background. Arguments that swirled around the reconstruction of Berlin after reunification had similar strands of exclusion and inclusion as competing camps sought to shape the culture and meaning of the city. The Turkish population, many of whom are now Berlin-born, have suffered many indignities and have largely been forced out from the city center. Their contribution to Berlin as a city is ignored. Another source of dispute was the collection of international modernist architects brought in by multinationals, largely in opposition to local architects, to dominate the Potsdamer Platz. Berliners were caught between a frying pan of a globalized aesthetic, the Disneylandification of the Berlin Wall, and the fire of a proacrical nationalism. With the potential for a virulent rejection of foreigners and immigrants, capital must wade into the culture wars if it is to pursue its desire for monopoly rents that are at stake through interventions in the field of culture, history, heritage, aesthetics, and meanings. Open data is a digital commons which is being distorted. The Omidyar Network is deeply involved in the open government partnership at the international level, in Code for America in the USA, and is the first major investor in the UK Open Data Institute. At Code for America, which describes itself as a new kind of public service, Omidyar has funded an accelerator arm that invests in startups, conveniently augmenting the idea of service with the contradictory idea of entrepreneurship and blurring the boundaries between those who want to make money from government contracts and those who want to contribute to a stronger civic space. As described in Chapter 7, the Open Data Initiative has been colonized by major financial interests. The major conferences have been sponsored by the big software companies. What was once an initiative focused on the release of data for civic use, a contribution to government transparency, becomes instead a handover of civic resources to the data brokers and insurance companies who can use it to optimize their business models. In 2012, change.org, a website that hosts petitions and that made its name thanks to the actions of many progressive organizations that ran campaigns on the site, joined Couchsurfing as a .org site with a for-profit motive, a misleading presentation of the organization's nature. In May 2013, it took venture capital from the Omidyar Network and started allowing corporate advertising, Republican Party solicitations, AstroTurf campaigns, anti-abortion or anti-union ads, and other controversial sponsorships. The change in mission was described by Lindsay Beierstein in These Times and Ryan Grimm in the Huffington Post. The Omidyarchange.org press release uses the standard language of social entrepreneurs, blandly inspirational and content-free. Every challenge is a problem rather than a conflict. In their words, quote, social enterprises can play an instrumental role in solving some of the world's biggest problems, Rattray said. This funding will help us continue to expand our empowerment tools internationally while innovating on new products with the potential for disruptive social impact, unquote. As the final example of the distortion of a commons, consider peer-to-peer lending company Lending Club. Set up in 2007, it is now the leader in a wave of innovations that Rachel Botsman described with typical enthusiasm. Quote, a new generation of person-to-person and crowd-driven funding, lending, currency, and investment services that will decentralize and democratize finance, money, and banking. It is the subject that I am passionate about. How can we shift banking back to being a trusted pillar of society? How can we create monetary systems where the real benefits flow back to individuals, not the big financial megastores? How can we create financial access to underserved communities? The lending club model takes the idea of microfinance socially driven instruments and applies it to personal loans. Here is the economist's take on how it works. Quote, fans compare peer-to-peer lenders to other pioneers of the sharing economy, like Uber with cars and Airbnb with accommodation. The newcomers are making available a commodity they do not provide themselves, in this case, money. Instead of a bank intermediating between savers and borrowers, the two parties deal with each other directly. The platforms do the credit scoring and make profit from arrangement fees, not from the spread between lending and deposit rates. Like other areas of the sharing economy, Lending Club seeks to appeal to both the heart and the wallet. The New York Times describes its blend of altruism and yield this way. By cutting banks out of the process, borrowers typically got a lower interest rate than they would have paid on a credit card or a loan with collateral. And individual lenders earned higher returns, averaging in the high single digits. than they would have received by parking their money in a savings account or a certificate of deposit. Like other areas of the sharing economy, peer-to-peer lending is booming. The Economist continues, quote, "The sector has grown rapidly. The five biggest platforms for consumer lending, LendingClub, Prosper, SoFi, all based in San Francisco, and Zopa, RateSetter, in London, have so far issued nearly 1 million loans between them and are generating at a rate of well over $10 billion a year. These loans are still dwarfed by the $3 trillion of consumer debt outstanding in America alone. But the sector is doubling its lending roughly every 9 months, and almost everyone expects it to keep on growing rapidly," unquote. If it all sounds too good to be true, that is because it is. By qualifying loan applicants, LendingClub is managing a common resource for lenders. Once it became clear that LendingClub was a source of potential borrowers, big financial firms realized they could take advantage of this commons. Hedge funds were the first institutions to join the opportunity, and now big financial firms, not small investors, dominate lending on the two platforms, LendingClub and its competitor Prosper. While peer-to-peer loans were primarily fractional, in that small lenders would combine to fund a loan, by March 2015, 65% or more than $3 billion in loans on the two platforms, Prosper and LendingClub, came from investors snatching up whole loans, which are almost always made by institutional investors rather than individuals. LendingClub's evolution is similar to that of eBay, as discussed in Chapter 7. Starting as a marketplace for individuals, eBay has ended up as another way for major chains to reach customers. Both companies adopted a blockbuster strategy, partnering with big organizations at the expense of their original model. High-profile partnerships, such as LendingClub's April 2015 partnership with Citigroup, was to make $150 million in loans available, emphasize how much the so-called disruptor has come to feel at home among the establishment, and how completely the promise of avoiding the banking system has morphed into just another wing of the vast banking system. Peer-to-peer lending marketplaces have transformed themselves into loan originators and underwriters for traditional banks, and left any notion of financial democratization far behind. Recently, the peer-to-peer lending companies have rebranded themselves as marketplace lending companies. The major institutions now make up not only the majority of the loans, but they take the best ones. When investing is done by computers, those with the best computers will make the best loans. So the big institutions take the pick of the crop. These leaving the original LendingClub audience of individual investors with the bottom of the barrel. Some of Wall Street's biggest names have joined the marketplace lending as a board members and investors and investment banks vied to manage LendingClub's initial public offering in December 2014. When peer-to-peer lending advocate Jonathan McMillan attended the industry conference LendIt in 2015, he found that the initial idea of connecting borrowers and lenders directly has been abandoned. Now hedge funds assist managers and banks and are using marketplace lending as a supplier of loans in their chase for yield. Asset managers have started securitized marketplace loans into asset-based securities, and hedge funds use large amounts of borrowed money to leverage their investments. Some investors are already talking about the need to create credit default swaps for marketplace loans. The problems of alienation, erosion, and distortion all sharpen at the scale of financial involvement. scaling economy advocates who seek to recapture the egalitarian, sustainable, and community focus that inspired many to join the movement can now only do so by avoiding the temptations of believing in a technological fix for society, powered by venture capital and free markets, instead of scaling up efforts around sharing and involvement of capital. It only leads to broken promises.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you're listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenary. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
Every year, countless people succumb to the temptation to purchase exotic animals like hedgehogs, lizards, monkeys, even tigers and bears to keep as pets. But life in captivity is often a death sentence for these animals, who may suffer from malnutrition, an improper environment, and the stress of confinement. For more information on this issue, visit the BCSPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenary, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We are looking at What's Yours is Mine, Against the Sharing Economy by Tom Slee. Chapter 9, What's Yours is Mine. In a few short years, the sharing economy has gone from generosity of what's mine is yours to the self-interest of what's yours is mine. As the non-commercial values invoked by the phrase sharing economy have been left behind or reduced to public relations exercises. The main impulse that drove the writing of this book was a sense of betrayal. That what started as an appeal to community, person-to-person connections, sustainability, and sharing has become the playground of billionaires, Wall Street, and venture capitalists, extending their free market values even further into their personal lives. The promise of a more personal alternative to a corporate world, instead driving a harsher form of capitalism, deregulation, new forms of entitled consumerism, and a new world of precarious work. There's a lot of talk of democratization and networks, but what happened instead is the separation of risk spread around service providers and customers from reward, which accrues to the platform owners. Despite the claims of ecological sustainability embodied in ideas like access over ownership and the reuse of excess capacity in the on-demand sector, instead encouraging new forms of privileged consumerism, lifestyle as a service. What is particularly sad is that many well-intentioned people who hold a misplaced faith in the intrinsic abilities of the internet to promote egalitarian community and trust have unwittingly aided and abetted this accumulation of private fortune and the construction of new and exploitative forms of employment. Trends. Approaching the end of 2015, the tension between capital and commons in the sharing economy, set out in Chapter 8, has stretched to the breaking point as money poured into the sector and has turned from a trickle into a flood. Take Airbnb, which for all its faults maintains an aura of the original ideas of sharing. While the ride-sharing and on-demand companies may be creating precarious forms of work, Airbnb hosts are not in general in the same category. And there is a role for a low-intensity form of travel in which people share accommodations and swap homes. The traveler's urge to engage in cheap personal forms of travel outside the mainstream have taken different forms at different times. youth hosteling and formal sharing of holiday homes, my childhood holidays with Miss Whitaker, the couch surfing are all examples of this impulse. But Airbnb's mandate is to take these impulses and scale them up through its platform. In taking this path, Airbnb risks eroding the culture from which it had originated. Airbnb keeps up the talk of community, but it continues to promote the acquisition instincts of its hosts. Despite the SEPA-tinted photos on the Airbnb website, the company's business is no longer built on strangers sharing home cooking around a dinner table. It is built on the, quote, whole home rentals, in which the host and the guest may never meet. In a recent initiative, the company has announced its intention to move into the lucrative world of business travel, but only hosts offering entire homes will be allowed to participate. And these hosts are encouraged to offer an increased level of professionalism. We can expect to see more professionalism, less personal contact, and to see Airbnb partners with other travel giants, perhaps even major hotel chains, as the company follows its path of growth. At the same time, Airbnb insists that these hosts do not need the regulation and the costs that go with professionalism. The picture of a small-scale, intimate exchange is a key to the environmental sustainability claims of the sharing economy companies. But such claims increasingly read as a selective truce of company marketing departments. Airbnb trumpets its environmental impact by comparing the energy use of Airbnb travelers to the impact of the same number of people staying in common hotels. But when it comes to economic impact, it compares its impact to the same number of people staying at home. Uber and Lyft compare their environmental impacts to people driving private cars than to people riding buses or taking the subway. They claim that their relatively small car pooling operations demonstrate their commitment to the environment, but avoid talking about their impact on congestion and average driving speeds in cities like New York. We're going to be examining this and probably conclude this book next show. So please stay tuned for the grand finale.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby. And Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. We are rooted in community support and engagement. Thank you for helping us stay on air.
From Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. At Simon Fraser University's Morris J. Wask Center for Dialogue, the Mitigating Wildfire Initiative is putting preventative measures, indigenous stewardship, and community partnerships at the forefront of wildfire mitigation. From creating partnerships with communities most impacted by wildfire, to even creating resources on how to effectively communicate on wildfires, the initiative wants to make clear that there are numerous approaches to help address BC's yearly wildfire season. To learn more about some of these approaches, we sat down for a conversation